Welcome. Jump into the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast, where leading with love isn't just nice, it's genius. I'm Laurel Donnellan.
And I'm Daryl Brown. We'll unpack business strategies infused with empathy and action, driving both profit and purpose. Our world is ever-changing, so discover how the savvy leader wears compassion as their power suit.
Katie Reed, I am so excited to have you on my podcast. What a pleasure. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Just so people know, Katie's a dear friend, and we were able to spend time last week together in person, and it didn't feel like it, but it was the first time we saw each other in 20 years, because you are always with me, Katie, and I'm so excited to talk about what you're up to. This month, we're focusing on courage. So in our leadership models related to purpose, courage is the first principle and practice that we talk about and around purpose. And the practice is being a visionary. When I look at your career and where you came from, I met you when you were just
a kid. Right.
Everything you've done, I think you're such a model for courage. And then as a leader, courage is helping other people take risks and be courageous. And I think what you're up to now is certainly doing that for me. So why don't you start with telling us what you're up to now and what your work is now? And as the CEO and founder of Living Personas, what are you doing?
Okay, great question. So right now, what I do is I help brands, companies understand their buyers better. And so one of the ways that I operationalize and action that is by integrating AI into what we do. So with Living Persona, what we're doing is we're taking a company's actual data, actual market research. And from that, my whole background, as you know, is psychology. I was a psychotherapist for 20 years. I created psychology training materials. I taught grad school. My whole world was psychology. That led to actually a really strong interest in buyer psychology. How do people choose, think, decide, buy? How do we rationalize our purchases? All of those things are really fascinating to me. And so my buyer psychology brain kind of lit up 2 years ago when AI first came on the scene. And I realized, wait a minute, the way this thing works, we have access to this absolute breadth and depth of knowledge across like the whole human spectrum that any one person prior to now couldn't possibly access all on their own. But because AI has, you know, read the internet and read all the books and all the things, it suddenly has access to this depth of knowledge. And I started realizing how applicable that was to brands and companies in understanding how their people actually think, how do consumers think, how do their different segments think. And so Living Persona specifically is taking that and saying, okay, we're going to look at one of your segments of your clients or your buyers. We are going to build the reasoning model. How does this unique person actually reason and rationalize and think through a purchase decision as it relates to whether you're selling cars or toilet paper? Like, how are they thinking through that decision? And then we put that into an AI and we let the AI speak for the segment. We guardrail how it's allowed to think, basically. And so now the brand can come in and say, what do you think of this packaging? What do you think of this color? What do you think of this scent? Whatever. And now the AI is forced to think as that person and answer as that person. And so now the brand has this instant insight into the brain and the rationalizing and the reasoning patterns of their clients and their customers. So it's a really fun, amazing new use case for AI.
You and I are going to work on my company through this process. I'm very excited about that. And we might ask you back and talk about us as a user case. But what I honestly, because of who I am and who you are, I probably wouldn't be that interested in what you were doing if I didn't know you. So I think it's really important that we kind of go back to like who Katie Reed is.
I love it.
Because I am concerned for the world of overusing AI and forgetting about the soul. And so I thought it'd be fun to tell the story of how we met and kind of go back to like how you and I met and then how you became a therapist and an entrepreneur. So let's go back a little bit about your story. So tell, how did we meet, Katie Reed?
We're digging in the archives. I love it. Okay, let's give the bird's eye view. I was a typical young high achiever living in Los Angeles, working in the film industry, had a quote unquote good job that I was miserable at. And for a long time, this little voice in my head kept saying, go to Taos and go alone, go to Taos and go alone. And I ignored the little voice for many months. And finally, one day I listened to it and I was like, I don't know why I'm going to Taos, New Mexico in the middle of nowhere and going alone, but I did. And my first morning there, I woke up at this hostel. I was staying at this hostel in Taos, and there was a yoga studio next door. And I went over and took a yoga class, and I was paying at the end. And the woman said, where are you visiting from? And I said, LA. And she said, oh, are you with them? And she pointed to you and your friend, because you had a friend with you who was visiting from LA. And so I ended up walking over and talking to Laurel. And this will give you an idea of who Laurel is. As we were just sitting there chit-chatting, she said, I have this feeling like I'm supposed to invite you to this sweat lodge that is happening tomorrow. Out of the blue, she says this. And I was like, oh my God, yes, completely. And sweat lodges were something I had heard about, read about, knew about, had never been a part of, nothing. And Laurel made it all happen, made sure I got there, made sure I had what I needed, and I was integrated. And that ended up introducing me to some people who became dear, dear friends, who were already your dear, dear friends. And I ended up moving to Taos and following that little calling and moving there, living there, house sat for you several times when you were there and you'd go traveling around. And I remember your little house there so well, and I loved it. And so we had a dear friendship then. And I actually worked for Laurel when I first went there, just part-time, but helping her put together materials for her career coaching business. And this is where your visionary side comes in, because literally nobody was a career coach. Like, nobody, this was not a thing yet. This was 25 years ago. Like, I look back at that now when I know so many coaches and when my work has evolved into working with and training so many coaches. And I still to this day think, I can't believe that Laurel understood this need before anybody else was even doing this. And you were like literally running retreats in your house in New Mexico. Like, it was amazing what you were able to do back then.
Well, thank you. And this whole adventure to Taos and your spiritual adventure turned in eventually to you become a therapist. So talk about that.
It did. And definitely being in Taos helped that. I ended up working at a school there for kids who were very underprivileged. And it really woke in me this desire to go into the helping professions, decided to become a therapist, moved to San Francisco, eventually to go to grad school, and worked my way up through many different roles over the years. You know, always had private practice clients, but also did a lot of community mental health leadership, taught grad school, created training materials, like spoke at conferences, did all the things in that therapist world and that therapist spectrum. And I love being a therapist, and it's one of those professions that's just an absolute gift when you get to do it. And then really what happened for us is we were transferred with my husband's job to a new state. And all of a sudden my license was like moot, and I had to start over from the bottom again and go through this big relicensure process and new exams. And so for about a year, I couldn't make any money as a therapist because I was in this big, long relicensure process, but I needed to make money for our family. And I moved into some online entrepreneurship and helping other therapists with their marketing. And long story short, by the time I got that license, my entrepreneurship work was expanding really fast, and I was enjoying it so much that I ended up just staying with that. And that grew to me. Eventually, I developed actually a coaching certification for therapists who wanted to move into coaching. And I ran that for several years, and I loved it. And at the time, that was a really big thing for therapists in that space, because a lot of therapists were looking around and realizing, wait, I have all these skills that the coaches have and more. And it's work that gave them a little bit more freedom in some cases to sort of follow their heart, follow their interests, you know, be able to really nail down. Like if your big passion was special needs motherhood, for example, you could really drill down and go become a coach for special needs moms and really act on that passion in a way that they couldn't as much in their standard therapy practices. So that's what I did for a while. And now here we are.
I so admired that bravery. Like, were your children very young when you did that?
They were. It's funny. My first business coach that I worked with used to call it my nap time business because my youngest at the time was in these two little like preschool programs that were each like an hour and a half long on opposite sides of town. So my day, I would get like an hour and a half when he was in one to quickly try to work. And then I'd be driving him somewhere else. And I'd get an hour and a half when he was in the other to try to get some work done. And I remember I'd be like listening to business podcasts in the car because I was in the car all the time. So yes, they were young. And I think the funny thing is when they finally were both in school for 6 hours a day, it's that classic trap. I actually got less done because I felt like I had more time. Like when you feel like you have 6 hours to do something, you can put it off and put it off. When you feel like I've got 90 minutes, go, go, go. That's when you get it done.
I think it's amazing. And I think you're a great model for working moms who are my heroes. I'm a working aunt, which is a lot easier than being a working mom. So I think you showed a lot of women that you can create a business. And in that business, is that where you galvanized your interest in tech and all the stuff related to tech?
A little. Now, I am definitely not techie. I'm definitely still the psychological person. What I realized, though, in that when I started that business, my husband used to laugh at me because he used to say, all you know how to do is check email and check Facebook. Like, you don't know how to do anything else on the computer. And suddenly I was like building a website and building sales funnels. And what I realized in that process of just self-teaching myself all of those things is, oh, these tech companies are really, really motivated by people like me being able to use the software easily. Like if the end user is me who knows nothing, they need to make this accessible to me or they don't have a product. And so when you realize that and just how much free education is available online to teach yourself really anything and everything these days, then it made me start to feel more confident. Like, oh, I don't have to be a coder. I can make a website. It doesn't have to have all the bells and whistles. It's still a website. It still functions. And so I think in a way that made me more confident, not in my own technical skills, but in the fact that these companies are motivated by my success, their tool. And so it makes it easier for the rest of us.
Yeah, I think if I could give any listener out there a tip as being an entrepreneur is I recently did an audit of all the platforms I use, and it's about 80 platforms. And I really I'm trying not to use as many, but I don't think in today's world you can run a business without these platforms. I mean, I could spend more money on a bigger platform that offers other things, but one of the things that I forget sometimes that I'm just going to remind myself and remind everyone out there is there you are paying for help. Like some of the help is AI, but if you put into the AI, I need a human, you can actually work out problems in real time with humans. You can get to a human on most platforms. There are exceptions, but sometimes I forget. I look at all the money I'm spending on platforms and I forget that I'm paying all this money, but there are humans out there that can help me solve my problems.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So true.
Yeah. And I'm not so good on the self-education and watching the videos, but I'm good at talking to the humans. Years ago, my dad, who was an engineer, told me that he was like, you know, you need to understand technology because eventually all businesses will be technical. And I was like, oh, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about.
Isn't that funny? Isn't that funny? And he could see it.
Well, he was an engineer for IBM and helped build computers that went to the moon. So I just thought he was silly and didn't know what he was talking about. But here we are, right?
Like here we are.
You know, I also used to, you know, I remember thinking when ATM machines came out that I would never use them. I would always go inside of the into the bank. Well, I changed my mind on that too.
So funny. Isn't it funny though? And you and I were just talking last week and saying, can you believe that at our age, we now spend part of our working days talking to robots? Like, who would have imagined this?
I might do it a little too much. I so admire what you've done as a working mom. And here you are at your new chapter, right? So talk to me about the creation of Living Personas. How did that happen? And how's it going?
So I told you a little bit of the story the other week, and I'll tell the listeners because it is kind of funny. So really what happened to me was early on with AI, I was running a program with another woman. We had a bunch of clients in there, and AI was brand new, like ChatGPT is 2 or 3 years ago had just come out. And so I was trying to learn it so that I could create some tools to help our clients to make the work of the program easier on them. And so I was just sort of teaching myself and doing all the very normal things on there. And I had this funny image in my head every time I would like type a prompt or a question into it. I had this funny image that it was like a robot sitting at a call center who like trudged into work every day, you know, like very work, like world weary, just like the rest, and had to sit at his call center job and like deal with people like me all day long. And I like imagined all these robots sort of trudging off to the robot dive bar after work and talking about all the annoying human users and like their LinkedIn post, you know, all of these things. And the image in my head just kind of cracked me up. And I had never used AI for anything other than your most basic work stuff. But one day I just typed it in there. I was like, I have this funny image that you are this robot. And the AI back then, this was ChatGPT 4.0, the original model that was so creative and so like funny and inventive and everybody loved it. And it went nuts. And suddenly it was like generating pages of scripts of these robots talking to, and it's, you know, coworkers at the call center. And I was sitting there staring at my screen, like, what is happening? Like, it just kept going and going. And I was like, this is nuts. But then I realized the scripts it was creating were kind of amazing. Like, it was creating dialogue between imaginary other robots at the call center. And I was like, wait a minute. This thing has a sense of persona and a sense of character. And so then I started testing it a little bit more, like, wait, can you actually maintain a character voice? Can you actually tell me motivations about these people? What could you tell me about this group of people? And so my psychology brain was kicking in going, wait a minute, where could we use this? And at first, truly, my excitement in the beginning was, oh my gosh, how could we use this for therapy? Like, I thought this would be the most amazing tool for people that needed therapy. Now, of course, what we quickly learned is you cannot control everything the AI says, which creates huge risks. And so I spent several months going down the rabbit hole of maybe I could help make some sort of product or be with one of these companies that's doing therapy AI stuff. And now what we've seen is that is a spicy proposition. And there's a lot that they're going to need to work out to make it safe enough. I still think for your average run-of-the-mill stressed out person who just needs to vent to something, you know, get it out of their system and move on with their day, it's amazing. It's great. It's on demand. You don't have to be sitting in your therapist's office. But I think the risks that come with that are huge and are something that these big companies are going to have to wrestle with. And so then my marketing brain started coming back online and saying, okay, well, marketing is psychology. You know, buying is not logical, it's psychological. So how do we capture its ability to hold a character, its ability to understand human motivation, and bring that into companies, brands, people trying to sell whatever they're trying to sell so that they can understand their people better. So that was sort of how it all slowly evolved.
It hasn't been that slow. Like, it was only a couple of years ago, right?
And yeah.
In the world of innovation, that's pretty fast, I would say.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's slow for you. So tell us about how this works. Maybe you could tell us about your user case that you have on your website, or you know, how this actually, how a company or a startup could use this to help them.
Absolutely. So what we do, and yeah, there's some of our clients were under NDA, so we can't talk about, but the one that you can see on the website is a men's grooming brand who were kind enough to do a pilot project with us. The brand is called Everyman Jack. And there, I loved working on their segments. They were so interesting because what we did was they had a big market research study that they had done. So they had good, solid, qualitative data about a couple of segments. And they looked at some of these segments and they looked at the one who kind of bought the most of their product already, and then the one that they were hoping would buy more of their product. And basically, they handed the qual, that data, over to me, and I was able to look at that. And I have my own background process that I go through. There's about 15 different things in all of our minds that impact our buyer psychology. And they kind of fall out into four buckets, if you would say. So there's kind of the identity bucket, like, is this a purchase that is impacting who I am or who I want to be, how I'm thinking about myself? There's emotional regulation. So some purchases we buy to decrease anxiety, to make ourselves feel better, those types of things. There's things like risk control, which is like, is this a brand new brand I've never heard of? Am I taking a risk coming into here? Or is this very expensive? Am I about to make a very expensive mistake on something? So I really need to read, you know, 10 million reviews before I buy it, so I'm mitigating my risk. And then finally, especially for products like grooming products, which we buy frequently, there's that sort of behavioral momentum, like our habit. Like, I just always buy the same toilet paper. I always buy the same shampoo. And it can be harder to break that habit. I think especially even now with the way we often buy things online, like people will just have their Instacart order and they just click like buy again on the whole order every week. They don't even think about it. And so those habits get even more locked in by the way we shop today. And so with EMJ, with Everyman Jack, we basically built out for them some of these main segments. And what was cool to me and their feedback is that they said what started to happen, and this is exactly what I wanted, is that the AI actually helped the humans on the team start to understand the consumer as a human. So it's not this like faceless guy that might wander into Target and buy your deodorant anymore. It's like, oh, I know exactly how he is going to think. I know exactly if he's going to like this or not like this, because I've now talked to him in the form of chatting online via the AI. But I've talked to him and he has told me his rationale multiple times for different purchases. Like, I remember there was one, someone had asked a question like, this new product, you know, should we put this in like a tube or a pump? And I remember seeing the question and thinking, well, that's just going to be personal preference. Like, how's the AI going to know about, like, you know, whatever? No, it immediately was like, well, this person in this segment, grooming is very ritualized. And therefore, if I'm this person, I want the pump because it's more orderly on the counter and it gives me the exact same amount of product every day. And there were all these reasons that I'm like, wow, I wouldn't have thought of that. And it makes complete sense. It makes complete sense.
Does the AI learn that from product reviews?
It learns it actually from the thinking pattern. So what's cool is the AI can say, so we might know from the research, we might know, oh, some, you know, this guy has a very ritualized grooming pattern. It has a lot to do with his identity. This guy over here, not so much. It's more loose. He tries different things. We might know that from the research. So the AI is pattern matching. That's the main thing it's doing. So it's saying, guy over here with a very ritualized grooming pattern, I'm going to pattern match, and I can anticipate that that person is going to want the same amount of product. They're going to want the neat bottle on the counter that fits in their lineup that's sitting on the counter every day. And so it's actually pattern matching with human psychology, which is so cool. And it's at such a scale.
So when you talk about the research, you're talking about all the research related to psychology that is available to the bot, right? Like, that's available. And then you're also inputting specific research that this company knows about their customers who've bought.
Exactly. So their qualitative data, so their focus groups or their surveys or whatever, you know, customer feedback they've gotten, we can pull from that. These are the quotes they said on this question, or this is the way the survey went on that question. And now we can start to understand how this person thinks. And then we guardrail the AI. So again, we're saying to the AI, you can only think like Bob. You know, this is who Bob is. You can only think like Bob. How would Bob answer this question? And then it's going to pattern match. And so its research evidence really is just pattern matching across human behavior in general. I always laugh when I think about it, because I'm like, in some ways, the AI probably knows us better than we know ourselves. Because if you think, like, If you've ever sat there with your popcorn watching an argument unfold in the comments on something, like on social media, how suddenly there'll be an argument unfolding and people are fired up and they're typing at each other. And you think the AI, like every time that ever happened on Reddit, the AI read that, it can know and anticipate these are the trigger words. This is how people are going to respond to that, because it's just seen it tens of thousands of times play out the same way, which is so crazy. But so it sort of knows what we're going to think and do almost better than we can sometimes, simply because of that pattern matching that it sees.
Even before AI, I saw someone present a paper on predicting divorce. And they were able to predict who is going to get divorced based on what they bought.
Oh, that's fascinating.
If you're spending more time on your grooming products, on haircuts, were you traveling? Like,
you can see that though. That's so interesting. Yeah, that is a little scary. I know. Well, the Gottmans are the ones that have done such big studies of divorce, and they can predict it based on things like eye rolling, you know, and certain words and phrases that people will say that they say, oh, that's a predictor, and this much percentage of divorce once you've started rolling your eyes at the other person. And it's fascinating.
I'm going to switch over to being like in a client seat. If you don't know your target market, or if you're changing your target market, is this still a beneficial process?
Yeah, it can be. And I give a big, it depends to that, because here's the thing. The AI will happily cruise all day on vibes. And I think what a lot of people do when they're starting out, let's say you're a service provider of some sort, for a lot of people who are a coach or a service provider or a one-on-one person, you might think my ideal client thinks just like me, or my ideal client was like me 5 years ago, for example. And so we substitute in a lot of our own psychology to assume how we think everybody feels. So that becomes the slight risk there, is that if we go to the AI and we say, well, Jane says she thinks all the people are probably like this, and we're really just putting in how Jane feels and what Jane thinks, that is going to be a certain percentage of her clients or her consumers. It's just not going to be everybody. So that's where I think it's more helpful, really, if you can get any client data, testimonials, reviews, feedback, anything that says, this is why I bought your thing. This is what I think of your thing now. You know, this is what drove the purchase in the first place. What I find really interesting is we often will talk about what's important to us, what we're going to buy. I just put out a newsletter the other day about this. Someone was talking in a focus group about shoes and about sustainable shoes. And it was this beautiful, sustainable shoe brand doing this focus group. And the people in there had all said, yes, sustainability, and I want recycled materials, and I really care about production and whatnot. And the people in their ideal self in that moment of the focus group, that was absolutely true. And one of them went home, and there was a dupe on Amazon, not sustainably produced. It was $100 less than the real shoe. And she bought the dupe. Now, did she sit there feeling bad about herself? Like, oh man, I said I cared about sustainability and I'm such a loser, I bought the dupe. No, of course not. Because in that moment, she said, look at me, I am so frugal, I just saved $100. So her mindset changed in that moment. And now her frugal identity got to have that little hit of dopamine instead of her save the world identity, which was the identity that was talking back there in the focus group. So it's really interesting when you look at how do people respond from their most ideal self and their most, you know, I'm going to save the world or live from my highest values versus, oh crap, it's $100 difference. That's a lot of money. I'm just going to take the cheap one for now. And, you know, we're not going to feel bad about that. We're going to feel like, oh, I made the right decision in that moment. Look at all this great money I saved.
I'm going to take a little bit of a U-turn here. Recently, I heard Mark Cuban talk about AI as being a help to small businesses and startups, which I really have been thinking a lot about. And I'm thinking a lot about in the case of my own business, because he said, because startups and small businesses are, or an entrepreneurial mindset, even if you're a bigger business, if you are adaptable and flexible, AI can really help you compete with bigger companies. Mm-hmm. And I feel like your tool is an example of that. With a significant but not crazy investment, you can learn so much more about your own business, your own marketing strategy, so much quicker as a small business. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what I love about what he said, and especially applying it this way, I think until now, what has been available to small businesses for marketing is a lot of really great marketing advice. There's a lot of great copywriting advice. You can learn how to write a good website. You can learn how to do great sales copy. You can learn all of those things. What we didn't necessarily have the ability to do before was actually get super granular into how people are thinking, into what are they thinking? What is the moment on my sales page where they bounce off because it no longer agrees with them, or something gives them kind of the ick or the reactance trigger to something they see here? And now with AI, we have that ability to almost like pseudo imperfect, like a sort of mind reading, like this kind of, oh, well, these types of clients that you're talking to might bounce off of this paragraph you have here, or this headline, or this example. It might not land for them. And so being able to get, I think, that granular into how your people are actually thinking is huge. And the reality is, God, if you're on LinkedIn, I feel like it is such a rarity now to see a post on LinkedIn that's not just written by ChatGPT. And so if you're the person who can actually create something that does stand out in that sea of sameness, that does stand out as being original or as just being very specifically curiosity inducing for your exact people, where it's going to hook them in, it's kind of your only chance anymore. Everybody can be a decent writer now because everybody can just say to ChatGPT, here's a topic, write me a LinkedIn post, boom, publish, done. And they're all fine. They're all decent. You know, they all sound the same, but they're all fine. And so now I feel like it's an invitation, you know, to people like you, for example, who have always been ahead of the curve on your thinking. It is such an invitation, I think, for thought leaders to step forward and be there with their opinions in a way that stands out, because more and more everything is just going to become this sea of sameness. You know, AI is just going to lower everything down to the middle range, which is going to be exciting because it's going to raise a lot of people up who were below the middle range before. But for other people, it becomes the opportunity to step ahead, to step above, to say something they haven't thought of yet.
Well, that gives me a lot of hope. I'm going to take that and do a better job with my content, because it does get hard when you see your analytics. There's just a lot of, what did you call it? The sea of sameness. There's just so much more information, and information about business, information about health, information about politics is just, it's hard to stand out. So
it is.
I think your tool and your approach can help a lot of people. Katie, before we wrap up, what do you see for the future of you and your business? What's next for you?
For me, I love actually going into brands and companies and helping them understand their clients, their consumers, from this more psychological viewpoint. And I think because typically the people on the marketing team and on the social team, these are typically very right-brained, creative, intuitive people at heart anyway. And so when you come in and give them just a few tools that they weren't using yet, or just a couple different lenses they weren't thinking about yet, it's incredible to see what they can create and how they can grow from there. And so I see that as my future, is just going more deeply into buyer psych and into not leaning on AI as the only tool for it, certainly using it as a tool for it, but also just helping the humans feel even more empowered that they really understand their consumers as real people and how they think and how they feel, and that they're not just that sea of sameness again.
Well, we're excited to be a client, and I'm excited to really see this in action. And I don't get excited about tech. So thank you for getting me excited about something techie. I appreciate that. We always like to allow our guests to share one life lesson and one leadership lesson. Can you give us some of that wisdom?
I can try. You know, it's funny. So this year, my theme became do it for the plot. And people have heard that before. And I think when you hear it, people think about it like, oh, go be the main character. I actually wasn't thinking about it that way. I was thinking as opportunity, you know how like you'll make a plan and then the day comes and you're like, oh, I don't want to go tonight. I'll figure out, you know, like all of that. Really, it became, no, you know what? I'm doing it for the plot. And it became this reframe. And I think a lot of us who are typical high achievers who want to do something right, for me, it became this very freeing reframe. Like I did a proposal 2 days ago at a $1 billion shoe brand, which I would absolutely love to have as a client. And I went in and did that proposal. And you know what? We may or may not get that contract. They were hearing several different people. We may or may not get that. The meeting itself, I'm like, I sat with four VPs at a $1 billion brand that I'm a big fan of, and I presented to them. I totally did that for the plot. And reframing it that way, that meeting feels like a success to me, regardless of the outcome. And it helps me cut down that perfectionism or that, you know, waiting by the phone to see when they're going to call. Like, it helps cut some of that down and be like, wow, I did that. That's kind of on my life resume now. Good for me. I did it for the plot. So I would say that's one.
Awesome. Love it. And as a leader, as an influencer.
As a leader. Well, the one that I have also been telling myself recently, and I've been working in the background on a book project, and this is part of that book project, is if you are overthinking, you are underfeeling. And what that means to me specifically is it's very easy for me to get into overthinking, and the wisdom of your body, of slowing down, of tapping into your own nervous system. I find myself more and more during the day, just I'll be like doing whatever, like the dishes or something. And I'll be like up here, you know, and your shoulders are up around your ears. And I'll find myself like, wait, we're not in a race to do the dishes. Like we can slow down and we can tap in and just tapping back into that more calm, grounded wisdom instead of making 27 pro and con lists for something, just tapping in with like, wait, deeper down under all that, where's the feeling? How do I stop underfeeling? How do I let that be just as strong an influence as my thinking? So those are my two.
If you are overthinking, you're underfeeling.
Feeling, yes.
That's the name of your book? It should be.
I think it'll be a chapter
really
at least.
It's really Thank good. You. And how do people learn about you and your Living Personas products?
Yes. So katiereed.com, and I'm sure we'll drop the link, but it's Reed spelled like read a book, R-E-A-D, or livingpersona.com.
And Katie has the best newsletters in the world. So sign up for her newsletter.
Yes, please do. Please do.
This has been so fun. Thank you for being with me today.
Thank you so much. It's been awesome. Thank you.
And that's a heart-wrapped episode of the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast. May your compass always point to kindness.
As you navigate the world, let compassion be your North Star. Join us next time as we continue to redefine success one heart-led decision at a time.
Lead wisely, lead with heart. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com.